Texas, USA. Grover Carlson works as a fuel collector for the town's experimental bioconversion plant. The fuel he collects is dung. I follow the former White House chief of staff as he pushes his wheelbarrow across the pie-laden pastures.
Of course we got our copy of the Night Warren Jews report. What do you think we are, the CIA? We read it 3 months before the Israelis went public, before the Pentagon started making noise. It was my job to personally brief the president, who in turn even devoted an entire meeting to discussing its message.
Which was?
Drop everything, focus all our efforts, typical alarmist crap. We got dozens of these reports a week, every administration did, all of them claiming that their particular boogeyman was the greatest threat to human existence. Come on. Can you imagine what America would have been like if the federal government slammed on the brakes every time some paranoid crackpot cried wolf or global warming or living dead? Please. What we did, what every president since Washington has done, was provide a measured, appropriate response in direct relation to a realistic threat assessment.
And that was the Alpha Teams.
Among other things. Given how low a priority the National Security Advisor thought this was, I think we actually gave it some pretty healthy table time. We produced an educational video for state and local law enforcement about what to do in case of an outbreak. The Department of Health and Human Services had a page on its website for how citizens should respond to infected family members. And hey, what about pushing Phalanx right through the FDA?
But Phalanx didn't work.
Yeah, and you know how long it would have taken to invent one that did? Look how much time and money have been put into cancer research or AIDS. Do you want to be the man who tells the American people that he's diverting funds from either one of those for some new disease that most people haven't even heard of? Look at what we've put into research during and after the war, and we still don't have a cure or a vaccine. We knew Phalanx was a placebo, and we were grateful for it. It calmed people down and let us do our job. What? You would have rather we told people the truth? That it wasn't a new strain of rabies, but a mysterious uber plague that reanimated the dead? Can you imagine the panic that would have happened? The protests, the riots, the billions in damage to private property? Can you imagine all those wet-pants senators who would have brought the government to a standstill so they could railroad some high-profile and ultimately useless zombie protection act through Congress? Can you imagine the damage it would have done to that administration's political capital? We're talking about an election year and a damn hard uphill fight. We were the cleanup crew, the unlucky bastards who had to mop up all the shit left by the last administration, and believe me, the previous 8 years had piled up one tall mountain of shit. The only reason we squeaked back into power was because our new propped-up patsy kept promising a return to peace and prosperity. The American people wouldn't have settled for anything less. They thought they'd been through some pretty tough times already, and it would have been political suicide to tell them that the toughest ones were actually up ahead.
So you never really tried to solve the problem.
Oh, come on. Can you ever solve poverty? Can you ever solve crime? Can you ever solve disease, unemployment, war, or any other societal herpes? Hell no. All you can hope for is to make them manageable enough to allow people to get on with their lives. That's not cynicism, that's maturity. You can't stop the rain. All you can do is just build a roof that you hope won't leak, or at least won't leak on the people who are going to vote for you.
What does that mean?
Come on.
Seriously, what does that mean?
Fine, whatever, Mr. Smith goes to motherfucking Washington. It means that in politics you focus on the needs of your power base. Keep them happy, and they keep you in office.
Is that why certain outbreaks were neglected?
Jesus, you make it sound like we just forgot about them.
Did local law enforcement request additional support from the federal government?
When have cops not asked for more men, better gear, more training hours, or community outreach program funds? Those pussies are almost as bad as soldiers. Always whining about never having what they need. But do they have to risk their jobs by raising taxes? Do they have to explain to suburban Peter why they're fleecing him for ghetto Paul?
You weren't worried about public disclosure?
From who?
The press. The media.
The media? You mean those networks that are owned by some of the largest corporations in the world? Corporations that would have taken a nosedive if another panic hit the stock market? That media?
So you never actually instigated a cover-up?
We didn't have to. They covered it up themselves. They had as much or more to lose than we did. And besides, they'd already gotten their stories the year before when the first cases were reported in America. Then winter came, phalanx hit the shelves, cases dropped. Maybe they dissuaded a few younger crusading reporters, but in reality, the whole thing was pretty much old news after a few months. It had become manageable. People were learning to live with it, and they were already hungry for something different. Big news is big business, and you gotta stay fresh if you want to stay successful.
But there were alternative media outlets.
Oh, sure. And you know who listens to them? Pansy, overeducated know-it-alls. And you know who listens to them? Nobody. Who's going to care about some PBS, NPR fringe minority that's out of touch with the mainstream? The more those elitist eggheads shouted, "The dead are walking," the more most real Americans tune them out.
So, let me see if I understand your position.
The administration's position.
The administration's position. Which is that you gave this problem the amount of attention that you thought it deserved.
Right.
Given that at any time, government always has a lot on its plate, and especially at this time, because another public scare was the last thing the American people wanted.
Yep.
So you figured that the threat was small enough to be managed by both the Alpha teams abroad and some additional law enforcement training at home.
You got it.
Even though you'd received warnings to the contrary, that it could never just be woven into the fabric of public life, and that it actually was a global catastrophe in the making. Mr. Carlson pauses, shoots me an angry look, then heaves a shovelful of fuel into his cart.
Grow up.
Troy, Montana, USA. This neighborhood is, according to the brochure, the new community for the new America. Based on the Israeli Masada model, it is clear just from first glance that this neighborhood was built with one goal in mind. The houses all rest on stilts, so high as to afford each a perfect view over the 20-foot-high, reinforced concrete wall. Each house is accessed by a retractable staircase and can connect to its neighbor by a similarly retractable walkway. The solar cell roofs, the shielded wells, the gardens, lookout towers, and thick, sliding, steel-reinforced gate have all served to make Troy an instant success with its inhabitants, so much so that its developer has already received 7 more orders across the continental United States. Troy's developer, chief architect, and first mayor is Mary Jo Miller.
Oh yeah, I was worried. I was worried about my car payments and Tim's business loan. I was worried about that widening crack in the pool and the new non-chlorinated filter that still left an algae film. I was worried about our portfolio, even though my e-broker assured me this was just first-time investor jitters and that it was much more profitable than a standard 401k. Aiden needed a math tutor. Jenna needed just the right Jamie Lynn Spears cleats for soccer camp. Tim's parents were thinking of coming to stay with us for Christmas. My brother was back in rehab. Finley had worms. One of the fish had some kind of fungus growing out of its left eye. These were just some of my worries. I had more than enough to keep me busy.
Did you watch the news?
Yeah, for about 5 minutes every day. Local headlines, sports, celebrity gossip. Why would I want to get depressed by watching TV? I could do that just by stepping on the scale every morning.
What about other sources? Radio?
Morning drive time. That was my zen hour. After the kids were dropped off, I'd listen to...
Name withheld for legal reasons.
His jokes helped me get through the day.
What about the internet?
What about it? For me, it was shopping. For Jenna, it was homework. For Tim, it was... stuff he kept swearing he'd never look at again. The only news I ever saw was what popped up on my AOL welcome page.
At work, there must have been some discussion.
Oh, yeah, at first. It's kind of scary, kind of weird. You know, I hear it's not really rabies, and stuff like that. But then that first winter, things died down, remember? And anyway, it was a lot more fun to rehash last night's episode of Celebrity Fat Camp, or totally bitch out whoever wasn't in the break room at that moment. One time, around March or April, I came into work and found Mrs. Ruiz clearing out her desk. I thought she was being downsized or maybe outsourced, you know, something I considered a real threat. She explained that it was them. That's how she always referred to it, them, or everything that's happening. She said that her family'd already sold their house and were buying a cabin up near Fort Yukon, Alaska. I thought that was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard, especially from someone like Inez. She wasn't one of the ignorant ones. She was a clean Mexican. I'm sorry to use that term, but that was how I thought back then. That was who I was.
Did your husband ever show any concern?
No, but the kids did. Not verbally or consciously, I think. Jenna started getting into fights. Aiden wouldn't go to sleep unless we left the lights on. Little things like that. I don't think they were exposed to any more information than Tim or I, but maybe they didn't have the adult distractions to shut it out.
How did you and your husband respond?
Zoloft and Ritalin SR for Aiden and Adderall XR for Jenna. Did the trick for a while. The only thing that pissed me off was that our insurance didn't cover it because the kids were already on Phalanx.
How long had they been on Phalanx?
Since it became available. We were all on Phalanx. Peace of Phalanx, peace of mind. That was our way of being prepared. And Tim buying a gun. He kept promising to take me to the range to learn how to shoot. Sunday, he'd always say. We're going this Sunday. I knew he was full of it. Sundays were reserved for his mistress, that 18-footer twin-engine bitch he seemed to sink all his love into. I didn't really care. We had our pills, and at least he knew how to use the Glock. It was part of life, like smoke alarms or airbags. Maybe you think about it once in a while. It was always just in case. And besides, really, there was already so much out there to worry about. Every month it seemed a new nail biter. How can you keep track of all of it? How do you know which one is really real?
How did you know?
It had just gotten dark. The game was on. Tim was in the Barca Lounger with a Corona. Aiden was on the floor playing with his ultimate soldiers. Jenna was in her room doing homework. I was unloading the Maytag, so I didn't hear Finley barking. Well, maybe I did, but I never gave it any thought. Our house was in the community's last row, right at the foot of the hills. We lived in a quiet, just-developed part of North County near San Diego. There was always a rabbit, sometimes a deer, running across the lawn, so Finley was always throwing some kind of shit fit. I think I glanced at the Post-it to get him one of those citronella bark collars. I'm not sure when the other dogs started barking or when I heard the car alarm down the street. It was when I heard something that sounded like a gunshot that I went into the den. Tim hadn't heard anything. He had the volume jacked up too high. I kept telling him he had to get his hearing checked. You just don't spend your 20s in a speed metal band without... Aiden had heard something. He asked me what it was. I was about to say, I don't know, when I saw his eyes go wide. He was looking past me at the glass sliding door that led to the backyard. I turned just in time to see it shatter. It was about 5'10", slumped, narrow shoulders with this puffy, wagging belly. It wasn't wearing a shirt, and its mottled gray flesh was all torn and pockmarked. It smelled like the beach, like rotten kelp and salt water. Aiden jumped up and ran behind me. Tim was out of the chair, standing between us and that thing. In a split second, it was like all the lies fell away. Tim looked frantically around the room for a weapon just as it grabbed him by the shirt. They fell on the carpet, wrestling. He shouted for us to get in the bedroom, for me to get the gun. We were in the hallway when I heard Jenna scream. I ran to her room, threw open the door. Another one. Big. I'd say 6.5 feet with giant shoulders and bulging arms. The window was broken, and it had Jenna by the hair. She was screaming, "Mommy! Mommy! Mommy!"
What did you do?
I'm not totally sure. When I try to remember, everything goes by too fast. I had it by the neck. It pulled Jenna toward its open mouth. I squeezed hard. Pulled. The kids say I tore the thing's head off, just ripped it right out with all the flesh and muscle and whatever else hanging in tatters. I don't think that's possible. Maybe with all your adrenaline pumping. I think the kids just have built it up in their memories over the years, making me into She-Hulk or something. I know I freed Jenna. I remember that. And just a second later, Tim came in the room with this thick black goo all over his shirt. He had the gun in one hand and Finley's leash in the other. He threw me the car keys and told me to get the kids in the Suburban. He ran into the backyard as we headed for the garage. I heard his gun go off as I started the engine.
Part 3. The Great Panic. Parnell Air National Guard Base, Memphis, Tennessee, USA. Gavin Blair pilots one of the D-17 combat dirigibles that make up the core of America's Civil Air Patrol. It is a task well suited to him. In civilian life, he piloted a Fujifilm blimp.
It stretched to the horizon. Sedans, trucks, buses, RVs, anything that could drive. I saw tractors, I saw a cement mixer. Seriously, I even saw a flatbed with nothing but a giant sign on it. A billboard advertising a gentleman's club. People were sitting on top of it. People were riding on top of everything, on roofs, in between luggage racks. It reminded me of some old picture of trains in India with people hanging on them like monkeys. All kinds of crap lined the road. Suitcases, boxes, even pieces of expensive furniture. I saw a grand piano. I'm not kidding. Just smashed like it was thrown off the top of a truck. There were also a lot of abandoned cars. Some had been pushed over, some were stripped, some looked burned out. I saw a lot of people on foot, walking across the plains or alongside the road. Some were knocking on windows, holding up all kinds of stuff. A few women were exposing themselves. They must have been looking to trade, probably gas. They couldn't have been looking for rides. They were moving faster than cars. It wouldn't make sense, but I backed down the road about 30 miles. Traffic was moving a little better. You'd think the mood would be calmer. It wasn't. People were flashing their lights, bumping the cars in front of them, getting out and throwing down. I saw a few people lying by the side of the road, barely moving or not at all. People were running past them, carrying stuff, carrying children, just running, all in the same direction of the traffic. A few miles later, I saw why. Those creatures were swarming among the cars. Drivers on the outer lanes tried to veer off the road, sticking in the mud, trapping the inner lanes. People couldn't open their doors. The cars were too tightly packed. I saw those things reach in, open windows, pulling people out or pulling themselves in. A lot of drivers were trapped inside. Their doors were shut, and I'm assuming locked. Their windows were rolled up. It was safety-tempered glass. The dead couldn't get in, but the living couldn't get out. I saw a few people panic, try to shoot through their windshields, destroying the only protection they had. Stupid. They might have bought themselves a few hours in there, maybe even a chance to escape. Maybe there was no escape. Just a quicker end. There was a horse trailer, hitched to a pickup in the center lane. It was rocking crazily back and forth. The horses were still inside. The swarm continued among the cars, literally eating its way up the stalled lines. All those poor bastards just trying to get away. And that's what haunts me most about it. They weren't headed anywhere. This was the I-80, a strip of highway between Lincoln and North Platte. Both places were heavily infested, as well as all those little towns in between. What did they think they were doing? Who organized this exodus? Did anyone? Did people see a line of cars and join them without asking? I tried to imagine what it must have been like, stuck bumper to bumper, crying kids, barking dog, knowing what was coming just a few miles back, and hoping, praying, that someone up ahead knows where he's going. Ever hear about that experiment an American journalist did in Moscow in the 1970s? He just lined up at some building. Nothing special about it, just a random door. Sure enough, someone got in line behind him. Then a couple more, and before you knew it, they were backed up around the block. No one asked what the line was for. They just assumed it was worth it. I can't say if that story was true. Maybe it's an urban legend or a Cold War myth. Who knows?
Along, India. I stand on the shore with Ajay Shah, looking out at the rusting wrecks of once proud ships. Since the government does not possess the funds to remove them, and because both time and the elements have made their steel necks to useless, they remain silent memorials to the carnage this beach once witnessed.
They tell me what happened here was not unusual. All around our world, where the ocean meets the land, people trying desperately to board whatever floated for a chance of survival at sea. I didn't know what Along was, even though I'd lived my entire life in nearby Bhavnagar. I was an office manager, a zippy, white-collar professional from the day I left university. The only time I'd ever worked with my hands was to punch a keyboard, and not even that, since all our software went voice recognition. I knew Along was a shipyard, that's why I tried to make for it in the first place. I'd expected to find a construction site cranking out hull after hull to carry us all to safety. I had no idea that it was just the opposite. Along didn't build ships. It killed them. Before the war, it was the largest breaker's yard in the world. Vessels from all nations were bought by Indian scrap iron companies, run up on this beach, stripped, cut, and disassembled until not the smallest bolt remained. The several dozen vessels I saw were not fully loaded, fully functional ships, but naked hulks lining up to die. There were no dry docks, no slipways. Along was not so much a yard as a long stretch of sand. Standard procedure was to ram the ships up onto the shore, stranding them like beached whales. I thought my only hope was the half-dozen new arrivals that still remained anchored offshore, the ones with skeleton crews, and I hoped a little bit of fuel left in their bunkers. One of these ships, the Veronique Del Mar, was trying to pull one of her beached sisters out to sea. Ropes and chains were haphazardly lashed to the stern of the APL Tulip, a Singapore container ship that had already been partially gutted. I arrived just as the Del Mar fired up her engines. I could see the white water churning as she strained against the lines. I could hear some of the weaker ropes snap like gunshots. The stronger chains, though, they held out longer than the hull. Beaching the Tulip must have badly fractured her keel. When the Del Mar began to pull, I heard this horrible groan, this creaking screech of metal. The Tulip literally split in two, the bow remaining on shore while the stern was pulled out to sea. There was nothing anyone could do. The Delma was already at flank speed, dragging the Tulip's stern out into several hundred feet of water where it rolled over and sank within seconds. There must have been at least 1,000 people on board, packing every cabin and passageway and square inch of open deck space. Their cries were muffled by the thunder of escaping air.
Why didn't the refugees just wait aboard the beach ships, pull up the ladders, make them inaccessible?
You speak with rational hindsight. You weren't there that night. The yard was crammed right up to the shoreline, this mad dash of humanity backlit by inland fires. Hundreds were trying to swim out to the ships. The surf was choked with those who didn't make it. Dozens of little boats were going back and forth, shuttling people from shore to ships. Give me your money, some of them would say. Everything you have, or then I'll take you.
Money was still worth something?
Money or food or anything they considered valuable. I saw one ship's crew that only wanted women, young women. I saw another that would only take light-skinned refugees. The bastards were shining their torches in people's faces, trying to root out darkies like me. I even saw one captain standing on the deck of his ship's launch, waving a gun and shouting, "No scheduled castes! We won't take untouchables!" Untouchables. Castes. Who the hell still thinks like that? And this is the crazy part. Some older people actually got out of the queue. Can you believe that? I'm just highlighting the most extreme negative examples, you understand. For every one profiteer or repulsive psychopath, there were 10 good and decent people whose karma was still untainted. A lot of fishermen and small boat owners who could have simply escaped with their families chose to put themselves in danger by continuing to return to shore. When you think about what they were risking, being murdered for their boats or just marooned on the beach or else attacked from beneath by so many underwater ghouls. There were quite a few. Many infected refugees had tried to swim for the ships and then reanimated after they drowned. It was low tide, just deep enough for a man to drown, but shallow enough for a standing ghoul to reach up for prey. You saw many swimmers suddenly vanish below the surface or boats capsize with their passengers dragged under. And still rescuers continued to return to shore or even jumped from ships to save people in the water. That was how I was saved. I was one of those who tried to swim. The ships looked much closer than they actually were. I was a strong swimmer, but after walking from Bhavnagar, after fighting for my life for most of the day, I barely had enough strength to float on my back. By the time I reached my intended salvation, there wasn't enough air in my lungs to call for help. There was no gangway. The smooth side towered over me. I banged on the steel, shouting up with the last bit of breath I had. Just as I slipped below the surface, I felt a powerful arm wrap around my chest. This is it, I thought. Any second I thought I would feel teeth dig into my flesh. Instead of pulling me down, the arm hauled me back up to the surface. I ended up aboard the Sir Wilfrid Grenfell, an ex-Canadian Coast Guard cutter. I tried to talk, to apologize for not having any money, to explain that I could work for my passage, do anything they needed. The crewman just smiled. "Hold on," he said to me. "We're about to get underway." I could feel the deck vibrate, then lurch as we moved. That was the worst part, watching the other ships we passed. Some of the onboard infected refugees had begun to reanimate. Some vessels were floating slaughterhouses, others just burned at anchor. People were leaping into the sea. Many who sank beneath the surface never reappeared.
Topeka, Kansas, USA. Sharon could be considered beautiful by almost any standard, with long red hair, sparkling green eyes, and the body of a dancer or a pre-war supermodel. She also has the mind of a 4-year-old girl. We are at the Rothman Rehabilitation Home for Feral Children. Dr. Roberta Kellner, Sharon's caseworker, describes her condition as lucky. "At least she has language skills, a cohesive thought process," she explains. "It's rudimentary, but at least it's fully functional." Dr. Kellner is eager for the interview, but Dr. Summers, Rothman's program director, is not. Funding has always been spotty for this program, and the present administration is threatening to close it down altogether. Sharon is shy at first. She will not shake my hand and seldom makes eye contact. Although Sharon was found in the ruins of Wichita, there is no way of knowing where her story originally occurred.
We were in church, Mommy and me. Daddy told us that he would come find us. Daddy had to go do something. We had to wait for him in church. Everybody was there. They all had stuff. They had cereal and water and juice and sleeping bags and flashlights and...
She mimes a rifle.
Mrs. Randolph had one. She wasn't supposed to. They were dangerous. She told me they were dangerous. She was Ashley's mommy. Ashley was my friend. I asked her where was Ashley. She started to cry. Mommy told me not to ask her about Ashley and told Mrs. Randolph that she was sorry. Mrs. Randolph was dirty. She had red and brown on her dress. She was fat. She had big, soft arms. There were other kids, Jill and Abby and other kids. Mrs. McGraw was watching them. They had crayons. They were coloring on the wall. Mommy told me to go play with them. She told me it was okay. She said Pastor Dan said it was okay. Pastor Dan was there. He was trying to make people listen to him. Please, everyone, please stay calm. The authorities are coming. Just stay calm and wait for the authorities. No one was listening to him. Everyone was talking. Nobody was sitting. People were trying to talk on their things.
Mime's holding a cell phone.
They were angry at their things, throwing them and saying bad words. I felt bad for Pastor Dan. Outside. Mommy was talking to Mrs. Cormode and the other mommies. They were fighting. Mommy was getting mad. Mrs. Cormode kept saying, "Well, what if? What else can you do?" Mommy was shaking her head. Mrs. Cormode was talking with her hands. I didn't like Mrs. Cormode. She was Pastor Dan's wife. She was bossy and mean. Somebody yelled, "Here they come!" Mommy came and picked me up. They took our bench and put it next to the door. They put all the benches next to the door. "Quick! Jam the door! I need a hammer! Nails! They're in the parking lot! They're coming this way!"
She turns to Dr. Kellner.
"Can I?"
Dr. Summers looks unsure. Dr. Kellner smiles and nods. I later learn that the room is soundproofed for this reason.
They were coming. They came bigger.
She begins pounding her right fist on the table.
They wanted to come in.
Her blows are powerful, mechanical.
People screamed. Mommy hugged me tight. "It's okay."
As her voice softens, she begins to stroke her own hair.
"I won't let them get you. Shh."
Now she bangs both fists on the table. Her strikes become more chaotic, as if to simulate multiple ghouls.
"Brace the door! Hold it! Hold it!" The windows broke. The windows in front next to the door. The lights got black. Grown-ups got scared. They screamed. Shh, baby. I won't let them get you.
Her hands go from her hair to her face, gently stroking her forehead and cheeks. Sharon gives Kellner a questioning look. Kellner nods.
They're coming in! Shoot 'em! Shoot 'em! I won't let them get you! I won't let them get you!
Sharon suddenly looks away, over my shoulder to something that isn't there.
The children! Don't let them get the children! That was Mrs. Carmode. Save the children! Save the children! Pew, pew!
Pew, pew! She balls her hands into a large double fist, bringing it down hard on an invisible form.
Now the kids started crying.
She simulates stabbing, punching, striking with objects.
Abby cried hard. Mrs. Carmode picked her up.
She mimes lifting something or someone up and swinging them against the wall.
And then Abby stopped.
She goes back to stroking her own face. Her mother's voice has become harder.
Shh. It's okay, baby. It's okay.
Her hands move down from her face to her throat, tightening into a strangling grip.
I won't let them get you. I won't let them get you.
Dr. Summers makes a move to stop her. Dr. Kellner puts up a hand. Sharon suddenly ceases, throwing her arms out to the sound of a gunshot.
Warm and wet. Salty in my mouth, stinging my eyes. Arms picked me up and carried me.
She gets up from the table, mimicking a motion close to a football.
Carried me into the parking lot. Run, Sharon! Don't stop!
This is a different voice now, not her mother's.
Just run! Run, run, run! They pulled her away from me. Her arms let me go. They were big, soft arms.
Kujir, Olkhan Island, Lake Baikal, the Holy Russian Empire. The room is bare except for a table, two chairs, and a large wall mirror, which is almost sure to be one-way glass. I sit across from my subject, writing on the pad provided for me. My transcriber has been forbidden for security reasons. Maria Zhuganova's face is worn. Her hair is graying. Her body strains the seams of the fraying uniform she insists on wearing for this interview. Technically, we are alone. Although I sense watching eyes behind the room's one-way glass.
We didn't know that there was a great panic. We were completely isolated. About a month before it began, about the same time as that American newswoman broke the story, our camp was placed on indefinite communication blackout. All the televisions were removed from the barracks, all the personal radios and cell phones, too. I had one of those cheap disposable types with 5 prepaid minutes. Was all my parents could afford. I was supposed to use it to call them on my birthday, my first birthday away from home. They were stationed in North Ossetia, Alanya, one of our wild southern republics. Our official duty was peacekeeping, preventing ethnic strife between the Ossetia and English minorities. Our rotation was up about the same time they cut us off from the world. A matter of state security, they called it.
Who were they?
Everyone. Our officers, the military police, even a plainclothes civilian who just seemed to appear one day out of nowhere. He was a mean little bastard with a thin red face. That's what we called him, red face.
Did you ever try to find out who he was?
But me personally, never. Neither did anyone else. Oh, we griped, soldiers always gripe, but there also wasn't time for any serious complaints, right? After the blackout was put into effect, we were placed on full combat alert. Up until then, it had been easy duty. Lazy, monotonous, and broken only by the occasional mountain stroll. Now we were in those mountains for days at a time with full battle dress and ammo. We were in every village, every house. We questioned every peasant and traveler and, I don't know, goat that crossed our path.
Questioned them? For what?
I didn't know. Is everyone in your family present? Has anyone gone missing? Has anyone been attacked by a rabid animal or man? That was the part that confused me the most. Rabid. I understood the animal part, but man. There were a lot of physical inspections, too, stripping these people to their bare skin while the medics searched every inch of their bodies for something. We weren't told what. It didn't make sense. Nothing did. We once found a whole cache of weapons, 74s, a few older 47s, plenty of ammo, probably bought from some corrupt opportunist right in our battalion. We didn't know who the weapons belonged to, drug runners or the local gangsters, maybe even those supposed reprisal squads that were the reason for our deployment in the first place. And what did we do? We left it all. That little civilian, Redface, he had a private meeting with some of the village elders. I don't know what was discussed, but I can tell you that they looked scared half to death, crossing themselves, praying silently. We didn't understand. We were confused, angry. We didn't understand what the hell we were doing out there. We had this one old veteran in our platoon, Baburin. He'd fought in Afghanistan and twice in Chechnya. It was rumored that during Yeltsin's crackdown, his BMP was the first to fire on the Duma. We used to like to listen to his stories. He was always good-natured, always drunk, when he thought he could get away with it. He changed after the incident with the weapons. He stopped smiling. There were no more stories. I don't think he ever touched a drop after that. And when he spoke to you, which was rare, the only thing he ever said was, "This isn't good. Something's going to happen." Whenever I tried to ask him about it, he would just shrug and walk away. Morale was pretty low after that. People were tense, suspicious. Redface was always there in the shadows, listening, watching, whispering into the ears of our officers. He was with us the day we swept a little no-name town, this primitive hamlet at what looked like the edge of the world. We'd executed our standard searches and interrogations. We were just about to pack it in, and suddenly this child, this little girl, came running down the only road in town. She was crying, obviously terrified. She was chattering to her parents. I wish I could have taken the time to learn their language, and pointing across the field. There was a tiny figure, another little girl, staggering across the mud toward us. Lieutenant Tikhonov raised his binoculars, and I watched his face lose its color. Redface came up next to him, gave a look through his own glasses, and then whispered something in the lieutenant's ear. Petrenko, platoon sharpshooter, was ordered to raise his weapon and center the girl in his sights. He did. "Do you have her?" "I have her." "Shoot." That's how it went, I think. I remember there was a pause. Petrenko looked up at the lieutenant and asked him to repeat the order. "You heard me," he said angrily. I was farther away than Petrenko, and even I'd heard him. "I said eliminate the target, now." I could see the tip of his rifle was shaking. It was a skinny little runt, not the bravest or the strongest, but suddenly he lowered his weapon and said he wouldn't do it. Just like that. "No, sir." It felt like the sun froze in the sky. No one knew what to do, especially Lieutenant Tikhonov. If everyone was looking at one another, then we were all looking out at the field. Redface was walking out there, slowly, almost casually. The little girl was now close enough so we could see her face. Her eyes were wide, locked on Red's face. Her arms were raised, and I could just make out this high-pitched, rasping moan. He met her halfway across the field. It was over before most of us realized what had happened. In one smooth motion, Redface pulled a pistol from underneath his coat, shot her right between the eyes, then turned around and sauntered back toward us. A woman, probably the little girl's mother, exploded into sobs. She fell to her knees, spitting and cursing at us. Redface didn't seem to care or even notice. He just whispered something to Lieutenant Tikhonov, then remounted the BMP as if he was hailing a Moscow taxicab. That night, lying awake in my bunk, I tried not to think about what had happened. I tried not to think about the fact that the MPs had taken Petrenko away, or that our weapons had been locked in the armory. I knew I should have felt bad for the child, angry, even vengeful toward Redface, and maybe even a little bit guilty because I didn't lift a finger to stop it. I knew those were the kinds of emotions I should have been feeling. At that point, the only thing I could feel was fear. I kept thinking about what Baburin had said, that something bad was going to happen. I just wanted to go home, see my parents. What if there had been some horrible terrorist attack? What if it was a war? My family lived in Beacon, almost within sight of the Chinese border. I needed to speak to them to make sure they were okay. I worried so much that I started throwing up, so much so that they checked me into the infirmary. That's why I missed the patrol that day. That's why I was still on bed rest when they came back the following afternoon. I was in my bunk, rereading an outdated copy of Shemnazit. I heard a commotion, vehicle engines, voices. A crowd was already assembled on the parade ground. I pushed my way through and saw Arkady standing in the center of the mob. Arkady was the heavy machine gunner from my squad, a big bear of a man. We were friends because he kept the other men away from me, if you understand what I mean. He said I reminded him of his sister. I liked him. There was someone crawling at his feet. It looked like an old woman, but there was a burlap hood over her head and a chain leash wrapped around her neck. Her dress was torn, and the skin of her legs had been scraped clean off. There was no blood, just this black pus. Arkady was well into a loud, angry speech. No more lies, no more orders to shoot civilians on sight, and that's why I put the little Zhupolis down. I looked for Lieutenant Tikhonov, but I couldn't see him anywhere. I got a ball of ice in my stomach. Because I wanted you all to see. Arkady lifted the chin, pulling the old babushka up by her throat. He grabbed the hood and ripped it off. Her face was gray, just like the rest of her. Her eyes were wide and fierce. She snarled like a wolf and tried to grab Arkady. He wrapped one powerful hand around her throat, holding her at arm's length. I want you all to see why we are here. He grabbed a knife from his belt and plunged it into the woman's heart. I gasped. We all did. It was buried up to the hilt, and she continued to squirm and growl. You see, he shouted, stabbing her several more times. You see, this is what they're not telling us. This is what they have us breaking our backs to find. You could see heads start to nod, a few grunts of agreement. Arkady continued, what if these things are everywhere? What if they're back home, with our families right now? He was trying to make eye contact with as many of us as possible. He wasn't paying enough attention to the old woman. His grip loosened. She pulled free and bit him on the hand. Arkady roared. His fist caved in the old woman's face. She fell to his feet, writhing and gurgling that black goo. He finished the job with his boot. We all heard her skull crack. Blood was trickling down the gouge in Arkady's fist. He shook it at the sky, screaming as the veins in his neck began to bulge. "We want to go home," he bellowed. "We want to protect our families." Others in the crowd began to pick it up. "Yes, we want to protect our families. This is a free country. This is a democracy. You can't keep us in prison." I was shouting too, chanting with the rest. That old woman, the creature that could take a knife in the heart without dying. What if they were back home? What if they were threatening our loved ones, my parents? All the fear, all the doubt, every tangled negative emotion all fused into rage. "We want to go home. We want to go home." Chanting, chanting, and then a round cracked past my ear and Arkady's left eye imploded. I don't remember running or inhaling the tear gas. I don't remember when the Spetsnaz commandos appeared, but suddenly they were all around us, beating us down, shackling us together, one of them stepping on my chest so hard I thought I was going to die right then and there.
Was that the decimation?
No, that was the beginning. We weren't the first army unit to rebel. It had actually started about the time the MPs first closed down the base, about the time we staged our little demonstration. The government had decided how to restore order.
She straightens her uniform, composes herself before speaking.
To decimate. Used to think it meant just to wipe out, cause horrible damage, destroy. It actually means to kill by a percentage of 10. 1 out of every 10 must die. And that's exactly what they did to us. The Spetsnaz had us assemble on the parade ground, full dress uniform, no less. Our new commanding officer gave a speech about duty and responsibility, about our sworn oath to protect the motherland, and how we had betrayed that oath with our selfish treachery and individual cowardice. I'd never heard words like that before. Duty, responsibility. Russia, my Russia, was nothing but an apolitical mess. We lived in chaos and corruption. We were just trying to get through the day. Even the army was no bastion of patriotism. It was a place to learn a trade, get food and a bed and maybe even a little money to send home when the government decided it was convenient to pay its soldiers. Oh, to protect the motherland. Those weren't the words of my generation. That was what you hear from old, great patriotic war veterans, the kind of broken, demented geezers who used to besiege Red Square with their tattered Soviet banners and rows of medals pinned to their faded, moth-eaten uniforms. Duty to the motherland was a joke, but I wasn't laughing. I knew the executions were coming. The armed men surrounding us, the men in the guard towers. I was ready. Every muscle in my body was tensing for the shot. And then I heard those words. "You spoiled children think democracy is a God-given right. You expect it. You demand it. Well, now you're going to get your chance to practice it." His exact words, stamped behind my eyelids for the rest of my life.
What did he mean?
We would be the ones to decide who would be punished. Broken up into groups of 10, we would have to vote on which one of us was going to be executed. And then we, the soldiers, we would be the ones to personally murder our friends. They rolled these little push carts past us. I can still hear their creaking wheels. They were full of stones about the size of your hand, sharp and heavy. Some cried out, pleaded with us, begged like children. Some, like Baburin, simply knelt there silently on his knees, staring right into my face as I brought the rock down into his.
She sighs softly, glancing over her shoulder at the one-way glass.
Brilliance. Sheer fucking brilliance. Conventional executions might have reinforced discipline, might have restored order from the top down, but by making us all accomplices. They held us together, not just by fear, but by guilt as well. We could have said no, we could have refused and been shot ourselves, but we didn't. We went right along with it. We all made a conscious choice, and because that choice carried such a high price, I don't think anyone ever wanted to make another one again. We relinquished our freedom that day, and we were more than happy to see it go. From that moment on, we lived in true freedom, the freedom to point to someone else and say, they told me to do it. It's their fault, not mine. The freedom, God help us, to say, I was only following orders.
Bridgetown, Barbados, West Indies Federation. Trevor's bar personifies the Wild West Indies, or more specifically, each island's special economic zone. This is not a place most people would associate with the order and tranquility of post-war Caribbean life. It is not meant to be. Fenced off from the rest of the island and catering to a culture of chaotic violence and debauchery, the special economic zones are engineered specifically to separate off-islanders from their money. My discomfort seems to please T. Sean Collins. The giant Texan slides a shot of Kill Devil Rum in my direction, then swings his massive, boot-clad feet onto the table.
They ain't come up with a name for what I used to do. Not a real one, not yet. Independent contractor sounds like I should be laying drywall and smearing plaster. Private security sounds like some dumbass mall guard. Mercenary is the closest, I guess, but at the same time, about as far from the real me as you could have gotten. A mercenary sounds like some crazed-out NAM vet, all tats and handle stash, humping in some third-world cesspool because he can't hack it back in the real world. That wasn't me at all. Yeah, I was a vet. And yeah, I used my training for cash. Funny thing about the Army. They always promise to teach you marketable skills, but they never mention that, by far, there's nothing more marketable than knowing how to kill some people while keeping others from being killed. Maybe I was a mercenary, but you'd never know it to look at me. I was clean cut, nice car, nice house, even a housekeeper who came in once a week. I had plenty of friends, marriage prospects, and my handicap at the country club was almost as good as the pros. Most importantly, I worked for a company no different than any other before the war. There was no cloak and dagger, no back rooms and midnight envelopes. I had vacation days and sick days, full medical and a sweet dental package. I paid my taxes, too much. I paid into my IRA. I could have worked overseas. Lord knows there's plenty of demand. But after seeing what my buddies went through in the last brush fire, I said, screw it. Let me guard some fat CEO or worthless dumb celebrity. And that's where I found myself when the panic hit. Y'all don't mind if I don't mention any names, okay? 'Cause some of these people are still alive, or their estates are still active, and can you believe they're still threatening to sue after all that's gone down? Okay, so I can't name names or places, but figure it's an island. A big island. A Long Island. Right next to Manhattan. Can't sue me for that, right? My client, I'm not sure what he really did. Something in entertainment or high finance. Beats me. I think he might have even been one of the senior shareholders in my firm. Whatever. He had bucks. Lived in this amazing pad by the beach. Our client liked to know people who were known by all. His plan was to provide safety for those who could raise his image during and after the war, playing Moses to the scared and famous. And you know what? They fell for it. The actors and singers and rappers and pro athletes and just the professional faces, like the ones you see on talk shows or reality shows, or even that little rich spoiled tired-looking whore who is famous for just being a rich, spoiled, tired-looking whore. There was that record mogul guy with the big old diamond earrings. He had this tricked-out AK with a 30-mil grenade launcher. He loved to talk about how it was an exact replica of the one from Scarface.
I didn't have the heart to tell him that Señor Montana had used a 16A1 with an M203 launcher. There was the political comedy guy, you know, the one with the show. He was snorting blow between the airbags of this teeny Thai